welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us today. Coming up in just a bit, a little bit of a coding, a computer programming theme, if you will. We'll visit with the North Dakota Gateway to Science, and they'll share with us their upcoming coding workshops that are available for both elementary and middle school students. Plus, Tech with Peck. Is it still a good idea to learn a computer programming language? That'll be ahead on Main Street. And we begin Main Street today with a discovery that happened almost four decades ago under a North Dakota garage. This is A Closer Look with the Monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein from Prairie Public. A discovery made nearly four decades ago is finally being unearthed in northwest North Dakota. In 1988, mammoth remains were encountered while a Burke County property owner was building a garage. Before scientists could investigate, the foundation had been poured and the garage was standing. Now, an excavation beneath that garage is revealing a remarkable piece of North Dakota's prehistoric past. Joining us for a closer look with the Monitor is North Dakota Monitor reporter Michael Ockerling, who's been following this story. Michael, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having us, Craig.
Michael, this story begins in 1988. How were the first mammoth remains discovered?
When I was speaking to the state geologist, Clint Boyd, these remains, especially from mammoths, the Ice Age, it's under a grassland, and it's not like a typical fossil area where you'd see like in rock formations where you can see something exposed like that. So typically these remains are found during construction projects or when you're digging around in on your property. And that's exactly what happened here. Burke County property, a homeowner wanted to put an attached garage to their house. And so they hire out contractors. They start digging those footings for the foundation for the attached garage, and they hit something. And lo and behold, they ended up sending what they found to North Dakota State University to get it identified, and comes back sometime later as a mammoth remains.
By the time the North Dakota Geological Survey learned about the discovery, the garage had already been built, so why wasn't an excavation possible then?
When fossils are discovered on someone's property, it is up to the property owner to decide how to proceed. I mean, it's on their private property, and so the property owner wanted the excavation to be done, and which would have required
his garage.
Would have required his garage to kind of be demolished a little bit, especially the floor, the cement floor. And he wanted the excavation to be done within a month and the garage to be rebuilt. And at that time in 1988, there wasn't money in the budget for the Geological Survey to do that sort of excavation. So to tell you the truth, it kind of got lost by the wayside until sometime later.
I'm guessing the landowner may have thought, you know, that mammoth's not going anywhere. It's going to be available for someone to look at. But then here we go, 35 years later, what finally brought scientists back to the property?
Well, so when you have a state geologist like Ed Murphy, the former state geologist of the state, he served in that role for over 30 years. And he was going through some old notes that he had about this discovery. And, you know, he got a little curious. Like, oh, I wonder if the property has changed hands. And sure enough, the property had changed hands. And so he contacted the new owner of the property, who was very amenable to having the Geological Survey come out and do some looking around. And that kind of started this whole process. It was all just because he went through an old notebook and it's like, oh, you know, I should probably go back and check on this. Maybe there's some movement here. And sure enough, there was. And I think it's going to be lucky for all of us in North Dakota that he went through that old notebook.
You and me both. And before committing to a major excavation, which is what's happening now, how did the team determine there are more bones that are probably still there?
Well, they needed to use that ground penetrating radar. So members of the Geological Survey come out and they needed to get rid of that cement floor in the garage because there was rebar in it, and that kind of affects the ground penetrating radar. So once that was removed, they're able to get like a pretty good picture with this radar. They decided they wanted to excavate, and you know, that's kind of where we're at. And they know that it two phases kind of for this excavation. They wanted to take care of the garage portions first so they can get that kind of constructed for the winter for the homeowner. But then there's going to be some future excavations around the garage, possibly next year. I mean, we'll see. But they learned that, you know, hey, we should probably do some digging here. There seems to be something significant.
At what point, Michael, did the team realize that this mammoth was more complete than initially expected?
Well, what I'll say about that is when you're talking to a scientist about a find and they start getting excited, it gets you really excited. So talking to the state geologist, Mr. Boyd, when you go out to a dig, you don't know if you're going to find one bone or maybe a couple or multiple. And so when they dug down and they found out that it was more than just a single bone or even multiple bones, it was a true find. You know, they immediately knew that this was going to be something special, especially because there aren't too many mammoths found here in North Dakota.
There are some. How significant is this discovery compared with other mammoth finds? Do we know?
Well, it is going to be more complete. In 2023, in the Beulah Freedom Mine, they found a large mammoth tusk and some other associated bones with that of a Colombian mammoth. This one appears to be more. There appears to be a lot more bone and a lot more. There appears to be a lot more bones associated with it.
I've heard the term woolly mammoth through your reporting. Now I know there's a term Colombian mammoth. What will help determine what type of mammoth it was?
Well, they still need to get more. They need a more complete picture from the bones. Colombian mammoths were larger than woolly mammoths, and this specimen appears to be not as large as a Colombian, but that doesn't mean it wasn't a Colombian. It means it could have been an adolescent that maybe fell ill through malnutrition or maybe even some sort of bone disease. I know Mr. Boyd said previously that there were some curvatures in the vertebrae that would indicate that, which would be unique because that usually isn't found in North America. And it actually would tell you a lot more about that mammoth species developing that sort of disease. So they're still waiting to find out. They need more bones, and especially to find out the sex of the mammoth. They have ideas about what it potentially could be, but they weren't ready to kind of confirm that on the record yet. But that being said, they have started chopping around some names with the property owner. So this will be a named find eventually, it sounds like.
Just curious, is the property owner the person that gets to name?
Well, Mr. Boyd wants the property owner to select the name, and they believe that that's too much power. So wow. I'm not really sure how they're going to decide on the name, but typically, they are.
I
able
see
to
a contest
it,
so. Heading our way.
Let's put it online, just like we're naming a snowplow, only this is going to be a glorious mammoth skeleton.
Or the white buffalo in Jamestown. Right. I'm enjoying my conversation with Michael Ochterling. He's a reporter for the North Dakota Monitor. We're talking about the mammoth that has been found under a Burke County garage and how that dig now is progressing after almost 40 years. Michael, the bones appear to have been moved by water, you reported. What does their condition reveal about what happened to the mammoth after it died?
When they did the ground penetrating radar, they discovered that there were some rocks that seemed out of place for the area of the property that would be more associated with water. And so what they believe happened was this mammoth died, probably a number of yards, not miles, but a number of yards away from where it now currently rests. And they believe it was carried to this location through some sort of, water process, like a seasonal stream or ice melt. It probably carried it, a little bit to the site. And they can tell that because the bones are a little bit more rounded than they typically would have been. And they know it wasn't very far because then they would have been a lot more rounded than they're currently finding them. So it did perish pretty close to where it is now, but it was carried there by, it seems like, a seasonal stream.
Was there any damage that the original garage construction may have caused, maybe accidentally, to the skeleton?
Yeah, and Mr. Boyd, it's a very unique situation because typically you wouldn't find this discovery unless you were digging for it. And when you're digging for it, there's always a chance that you're going to damage something. But you're happy you found it in the first place. So yes, when they were digging the foundations for this garage initially in 1988, it appears that some of the bones may have been damaged. It may have been caught in some of the soil that they took out to kind of lay the foundation and then put back in as a backfill, a back soil fill. So yes, some of the bones were damaged. Not entirely sure how much or how many of the bones were damaged, but there was some in the construction process. But once again, we would have never known they were there unless that construction process happened. So I don't know if it
kind of the silver lining out of the construction damage things, just maybe just a little bit. I always wonder, and I'm sure the team hopes to find the tusks, and I wonder about the tusks. And I guess they're thinking they may be outside the garage. Mm-hmm. And why do they believe that, Michael? And well, what could they reveal?
They've done some pretty good digging inside the garage, and they haven't found them yet. But outside of the garage is still, they haven't found the edge of where the bones have laid yet. So they are very hopeful that they're going to find the tusks outside the garage. You know, male and female mammoths have tusks. And so, yeah, they are hopeful they will find them eventually. And so that kind of goes into the timeline of this whole thing, because they spent all of June digging up these bones under the garage, and so now they're trying to finish that up. There's some more plaster casts, some very large plaster casts that could hold multiple bones. Mr. Boyd told me one of the largest ones was 6 feet by 4 feet and about a foot and a half thick, these plaster casts, because that's how, you don't just dig them up and pry them up. No, you have to, you put a plaster over them and you kind of seal them into the plaster, and it really helps with transporting them. And then you can really take your time once you're in a controlled environment, like the Heritage Center and the State Geological Survey, to kind of then clean them and take care of them from there.
Michael, the excavation is taking place on private property, as we've talked about earlier. What accommodations has the homeowner made for such an unusual project?
Well, they've pretty much given up their garage for a number of months. Yeah, you can see in the photos from our story, they've dug down a few feet from where that garage was, or the cement floor was. And yeah, they're going to have to replace that. They were grateful that they didn't need to take down more of the garage, because, I mean, you get a large piece, you might not be able to get it out of there. But so far, so good. And they haven't needed to take down the walls or the roof. It's just been the floor. But again, this is going to, they've been at it for about a month. They're planning on going back and staying out at the site maybe in September to kind of wrap up the garage portion. And then early next year, they plan on going out there and excavating the outside part of the garage. So that's hopefully when we're going to find tusks and even more remains of this mammoth.
Do we know how long the broader excavation might take?
Well, after they finally wrap on the site, you take these plaster casts back to the bowels of the Heritage Center. That's where the fossil collection lives. And it's going to take a while to clean up all these bones and find out what you have there more completely. But the plan is, there hasn't been a final agreement signed, but the property owner plans to give these fossils over to the state fossil collection with the goal of hopefully displaying it in the Heritage Center a number of years later, because it is going to take a while for these things to clean. And in terms of budget, they needed a $150,000 appropriation during the 2025 legislative session to do this excavation. Mr. Boyd says they might not even touch all of it. There might be some turn back there, so it is going to come in under budget. And they may not need to go back to the legislature for another appropriation until they decide to do an exhibit. And that could be, you know, years late, 2029, 2031. Possibly.
If somebody discovers a fossil on private land, Michael, if you know, there are more in North Dakota, right? This is an isolated case for sure. What should that person know before maybe contacting the Geological Survey?
Well, they do have rights to these fossils if they are found on their private property and they are able to decide what happens to them. The only thing I'll say is, Mr. Boyd stressed, the Geological Survey wants to know about it. If you find a fossil or you find remains on your property, they want to know about it because they want to update maps for the state. They want to know where these fossils are being found, because that can really inform future digs around the area. Maybe other, you know, seasonal waterways in the area could yield some similar results. So they want to know about it, even if you don't want them to take it. And it's not people coming in black suits and sunglasses trying to take your fossils. They really just want to give you information, and they want to know what's there. And then ultimately what happens to it is up to the property owner. And I'm sure that they may, you know, suggest, hey, this would be good for everybody to see. Let's, you know, donate it to a museum. So
I want to stress, this is not the garage area in Burke County that we're talking about, a public fossil dig. But the Geological Survey does supervise public fossil digs. What have they found this year, and how can people apply for the 2027 season?
Well, the Geological Survey supervises some of these public digs. This year, I believe the Pembina Gorge, some areas around Dickinson and Bismarck, they had, they told me that the signups for these public fossil digs, they had about 160 people participate so far this year. the signups filled up in about 11 minutes. Wow. It was very, very quick for the signups for these public fossil digs. They usually announce, they'll announce 2027's dig sites at the end of the year around November timeframe. And then they'll do signups in the beginning part of 2027, usually the end of January, beginning of February. But yeah, they supervise these digs. And just this month, they were doing a dig outside of the Bismarck area, and they found a 3.5-inch T-Rex tooth. And the fossil finder, I mean, that is a good find. They usually find a few of those per year. So it is kind of rare, but not completely astounding. But still, it's a T-Rex tooth, you know, right near your town where you might live. That's
all part of North Dakota's prehistoric history, which is just so cool to contemplate. Michael Ochterling is a reporter for the North Dakota Monitor, and you can read his complete story and follow continuing coverage of the excavation at NorthDakotaMonitor.com. The North Dakota Monitor's reporting is always available free of charge. No paywall, no subscriptions required. Michael, thank you so much for joining us with a closer look with the Monitor.
Thank you so much, Craig.
The Trowood Performing Arts School presents Disney's Frozen, July 20th through August 1st at Bluestem Center for the Arts in Moorhead. Directed by Trowood alumna and Broadway performer Becky Galsvig. Information at trowood.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and learning to code can help young people develop problem-solving skills, creativity, and confidence with technology. This fall, North Dakota's Gateway to Science is offering free coding clubs for elementary and middle school students, thanks to funding from Marathon Petroleum. And joining us is Alicia Kellum from North Dakota's Gateway to Science. Alicia, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you.
Before we get into the schedules, what do students experience in a Gateway to Science coding club?
Coding is such a hot topic right now with kids, with adults, but kids are really wanting to figure out what is this coding thing all about? What careers are there that are attached to coding? It's very engaging. It's very hands-on. So in our elementary coding club, they really learn the basics and the fundamentals of coding. Online platforms, we have several types of robots that they actually will use to code, really to build those foundational skills in coding.
Marathon Petroleum is providing funding that allows you to offer these clubs free of charge. How important is that support in making the program even more accessible for families?
This is incredibly important. We are so grateful for the funding from Marathon Petroleum to be able to do these clubs and to offer them for free. These are really, truly very important learning points that any child growing up right now needs to know in the society we have. So we're very grateful for them.
The Elementary Coding Club begins September 24th. Who's eligible? Are there any prerequisites at all?
None. You can be someone who has never coded before, or maybe you've done quite a bit at school and you want to do more. We are looking for grades 3 through 5 with an interest in coding, and we do scaffold within the club based on how much experience somebody has with coding. And those will be every Thursday for 6 weeks from 4 to 5:15 right here on campus.
When you teach those fundamentals of coding, how do you make those concepts understandable? Because you can get really into the weeds with some of this stuff, but you also want to make it fun.
One of the most amazing things that has happened in my teaching career and now since I've been here is just how quickly kids pick it up. We think as adults of coding as this strange language that's hard to decipher. Coding really is following a sequential steps.
Logical steps.
Logical steps, just as if you were telling a story. What's the first part of the story, the end of the story, and then using logic to put the pieces together. Even kindergartners or students who are younger than that, that we have found during our preschool discovery hours, they can already pick up those fundamental cues. We're just pushing that forward in a fun, engaging, hands-on way.
And even in defining those steps, you get to kind of decide, do you branch left, do you branch right, and kind of make your own stories for some of these coding ideas. Students will work with online platforms and several kinds of robots.
Yes.
What will they do to program a robot?
We have all kinds of robots. In our elementary coding club, we have finches, rovers, We have mouse robots, we have dot and dashes. So they're going to be using iPads to actually create the code. And then the robot does what they ask it to do, really learning the steps, but also debugging, which is incredibly important. Something didn't work. It's not the robot's fault. It's my fault. How can I fix it?
The Middle School Coding Club begins November 9th at the Bismarck Veterans Memorial Public Library. How does that program then build upon that elementary level experience?
Yes, we again are really excited to offer that for free, but also with our partnership with Bismarck Public Library, we've had really great numbers having it there. So it's a great spot right in the middle of everything. We get to build with those 6th through 8th graders on what they've learned in elementary coding club. That's more in-depth learning. There are platforms that are much more complex. We actually start to get into other languages, and we really do that based upon what the students' interests are and do some self-learning. So they are able to, for instance, I want to learn Python. Okay, here's a place that you can go. Here's the support that we can offer, and then they can learn at their own pace based on what they want to do.
Even more advanced robots. Give me an idea of what advancements are in the robots they get to code.
Yes, so during this, we actually use some of the same robots, but we use them in a much different way. We have some challenges that are actually engineering challenges with the robots. We're adding pieces to the robots to form, to do things that we need every day. Like, we had a machine that would deliver pizzas that we created right in Bismarck Public Library, obviously on a much smaller scale, but how would that look within our city so that it was safe? We get into self-driving cars, and what does that look like, and what is the coding that is required for that? We also use rovers in a much different way. We look at color and light and sound and how that can affect coding. We can start a robot with clapping our hands and end it by telling it to stop. So it's really taking those first robotics and moving it into a little bit of a harder section.
Alicia, what do you hope students take away from the clubs beyond just the ability to write code?
I think first and foremost, people throughout my career, but also myself, someone who wasn't good necessarily at math. I was an English major, an English teacher. Having something like this that I became very good at built a lot of confidence for myself. And we see that every time we have elementary and middle school coding clubs. We see the confidence come out in the students, and that's number one. But number two, every time we have a club, we talk about careers, and we start talking about, you know what, I could go to school for this. Did you know coding was involved in this? They start bringing in that learning and what they want to do with it whenever they grow up.
Space is limited and online registration is required. How soon should families sign up, and where do they go?
We will be opening registrations in the middle of August, middle to late August, and sign up for coding clubs should happen as soon as possible. So watch the website. These coding clubs, obviously, they're free through Marathon Petroleum, but also because of the need and the want, they fill up very quickly. We will also have spring sessions, and that information is on the website as well.
And of course, families can go to gatewaytoscience.org. to find more information about not only what's happening now, but also what will be happening later in the spring. The Elementary Coding Club begins September 24th at North Dakota's Gateway to Science, and the Middle School Coding Club begins November 9th at Bismarck Veterans Memorial Public Library. Participation is free through funding from Marathon Petroleum, but online registration is required. Alicia Kellum is with North Dakota's Gateway to Science. Alicia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Still ahead on today's Main Street, would it be a good idea to still teach North Dakota students how to program a computer? That's ahead in Tech with Peck. Stay with us. This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. For decades, learning to create software meant mastering the rules and syntax of a programming language. Today, artificial intelligence can generate code from an ordinary conversation. That has given rise to vibe coding, describing what you want a program to do, allowing AI to write the code, and then refining it through additional voice prompts. But if AI handles the typing, the thinking, do people still need to learn languages such as Python, JavaScript, C++, R, or the language I know best, PHP? Well, George Peck joins us for Tech with Peck. George, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you. No, I've done some PHP coding. And the last time I did it the hard way. I went online to like PHP, you know, tutorial or whatever, just figured it out. That's the last coding I actually did using a language. Now, before that, I started it all with BASIC. BASIC. Okay. Yeah. What's the acronym?
Beginner's all-purpose symbolic instruction code.
Very good.
Yeah, I do remember that. PHP most commonly stands for Hypertext Preprocessor.
Okay.
Why is there not a P first? All right. That doesn't matter, George, for what we're talking about today, because learning it may not matter in the future at all. So before we get into the AI aspect of this, tell our listeners really what a programming language is. And why are there so many of them?
How do you tell a computer what to do? In original good old days, you would need to write code in kind of the language of the processor. I never learned assembly language. My wife learned it. But with assembly language, you were literally writing instructions to tell the processor what to do and how to move things in and out of memory. And I mean, I remember there was a stack, and a stack had a series of things that you could put on the stack, which would be push, and then you could go back to the stack and take things off the stack with a pop. Did I get pop and push right?
You did.
And I'm backwards. Okay.
You did.
And I mean, that was about all I remember about
it. You didn't know
assembly.
Binary fairly well, right?
I never learned it. And then binary. So my first language was BASIC on my Radio Shack computer in the late 1970s. And BASIC, it had that acronym, but the idea was it was a fairly easy to learn programming language. And the idea of an easy to learn programming language was one that if you understood general, terms in your native language, you could make sense out of things like go to and if then else and
while
and while when and do end and loop. So these are the constructs of programming languages, but the language and the keywords and the terms, a lot of computer languages is variable handling and memory handling, where you want to store somebody's name throughout the program and then put it back out at the end and, take that what's in memory and add some more onto it and take something off it. And then at the end of the program, output what that memory contained. And all of those things are what made up a computer program. So there were any number of languages. Some were faster than others. Some were slower. Some were easy to learn. The one I also learned was COBOL, Common Business-Oriented Language, which
the
was
the verbose
the kind of the language of mainframe computers, back in the 60s and 70s.
And mini computers, right? System 34s and System 36s,
and
IBMs.
Just so incredibly verbose. I used to say I could write an entire BASIC program in what would just be the declaration sections of a COBOL program. So these are all ways of telling a computer to do something. More recently, languages that are popular are Python. We hear about that a lot. R is a statistical kind of language. JavaScript started as kind of a web-oriented way of doing web page, more advanced web page coding. But JavaScript and Python, and I think to a certain extent R, are now the languages that we hear a lot about. And I've done a little tiny bit of Python coding, not a lot. I took a Python class online about 2 years ago and learned the difference between arrays and tuples. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, but now.
I thought during COVID, George, that every parent on the planet, it had been a good idea to buy their kid a Raspberry Pi, a very small $60 computer where they could learn a programming language. And then I go back to the debates at the time where should the state of Wyoming have every fifth grader learn to code? And that word has kind of changed meaning now. But the fact of the matter is now we have vibe coding, which I introduced just a little bit ago, which you and I briefly talked about this morning. And I've not heard that term before today, even though I had done it, had to look up to see what it meant. And it is, I would like to build a website that takes my favorite movies and sorts them by how much I like them when I'm done. And boom, all of the computer programming code is written almost instantly, and I have a program. But I just had to tell it what to do. Am I getting that right with what vibe coding is?
Pretty much. So I haven't done a lot of coding lately, I'll admit. But I've done some things, and one of the last things I remember was for my internet radio station, I wanted it to be listenable on an Amazon Echo device. So we have what is called an Amazon Skill. A skill is the ability for an Amazon device to understand the spoken command and do things like turn fans on and off, turn your television on and off, turn your sprinklers on and off, open your door, et cetera, or listen to an online radio station. So we need to build the skill. You then place the skill in the skill store, and you know, if you've got an Amazon device, you take it from there. So I'm trying to figure out how to do this. What I ended up doing was getting an account on Amazon and then starting this project, this skill. I discovered you had to write the skill code in either JavaScript or Python. So I didn't really know how to make this skill, you know, interject a web stream, an internet audio stream, and have a play button and a pause button, and then have you be able to say, you know, stop or resume or play. Or the really fun part was I coded the ability to say what song is playing now, and then the skill would go read a database and find out what song was playing. So I had to go steal, for lack of a better word, I don't like to steal, but I borrowed code from, I don't know, I Google searched it and found sample JavaScript code for an Amazon skill and pasted it in and did enough, you know, research in JavaScript to modify it and go read a database and do that work. And it worked pretty well, but it took a long time and I had a lot of learning to do. So about a week ago, I launched Claude Desktop and I typed in the following prompt: create an Amazon Alexa skill in JavaScript that plays the HTTPS, and I put the URL into the stream and clicked go. It wrote a whole chunk of JavaScript code and dropped it in the window. And I assume I could have copied and pasted it into the Amazon environment and had a working skill. Or if I've actually been in the Amazon environment lately, which I have not, I'm betting there's a button there. I can just do that as part of the integrated environment. It's just a very different process now. So it's hugely powerful and is making it a lot easier to write code, especially if you have not coded before. There was a New York Times reporter who last year sometime wrote a web app. He'd never coded before and put together a web app and wrote an article about it. So it's an interesting new way of getting folks into that world without having to know that language.
I think, George, you told me the statistic that Google now writes code every day. Well, guess what? 70% of it is written by, guess what? AI.
Yeah.
Not professional programmer. And that's what my degree is in. My degree is in computer science. And I would be very leery of getting that particular degree with the focus that I had in my professional career now, because certainly everything that I have ever done can be replaced by AI. But I'm wondering, though, if the logical thinking that's involved in understanding what a program language does is still valuable, even if you are vibe coding.
Yeah. So first of all, I wouldn't toss the computer science degree away quite yet. I would say get a little AI, attachment to it.
Sure.
And make yourself very valuable. So that would be the first thing. But the second thing is, yes. So the first thing that you have to be concerned with when you're vibe coding is I would have given Claude that prompt and taken that code and pasted it in and, you know, turned the skill on. And then would I have left and said, I guess it works. Does it? All right. If we think about AI, and we've talked about this before, if we do a Google search and use the AI result, we can find hallucinations, sometimes serious ones. The same potential inaccuracy can exist in vibe coded code. Code that at the very best may be sloppy, difficult to understand or read or follow, more possible it can have bugs in it. And it could be a, you know, minor bug when you tell it to play the internet stream, it doesn't work. Or when you ask what the song was, it doesn't restore the internet stream when it's done telling you what the song is. Any number of things that could be bugs. Some concern is that it's worse off and can actually introduce security vulnerabilities, open up, you know, holes. So there are still concerns that vibe coding, while it's very promising, you still want to, as you do with a lot of AI returns and results, validate it, verify it, and make sure it's doing what you want. That's pretty hard if you don't know the language just generated the code in.
Like a beautiful piece of literature, reading a well-written, well-formatted
piece of code, an elegant piece of code, as we say, is nice. Very nice. George, if you were going to give advice to a middle schooler who needed to decide, should I invest a year of my seventh grade life in learning a computer programming language, what would you tell them?
Yes.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Unequivocally think you should. I would definitely and still do advise that. I had a neighbor. She was about a 19-year-old girl who had not really done a lot with software or computers any beyond gaming and the things that we would normally expect. But she was curious about networking. So I spent an afternoon and explained networking to her. We went through my house and went through my router and talked about IP addresses and brought up the web page for the router and looked at the IP addresses that had been granted and the IP addresses that were fixed and explained how that worked. And she was excited and actually got into the business. And so I still think there's lots of possibilities for that. And I think it's a fascinating capability to be able to make it do what you want, not just by giving it a prompt, but by knowing the guts behind it, because then you can get very precise, make a little tweak, do exactly what you want, find that bug, fix that bug. So I think it's still a very valuable skill. Absolutely.
I have looked for places where people may want to go if they want to learn a programming language for free. And there are plenty of good choices online. Free Code Camp, Code Academy, the Odin, O-D-I-N project are places where one can go if they would like to learn. And of course, there are very inexpensive, cheap computers. I mentioned the Raspberry Pi earlier, that are wonderful tools if you're interested in learning a programming language.
So I took my Python class from IBM. IBM, International Business Machines, I Googled Python training and they offered this free program. It was really, really involved. Just search, you'll find them.
Well, George, really brings back some memories for me. I think that the very first programming language I learned in college was Fortran. And the
formula translator.
Yeah, math-based program. Yeah, actually wrote my first program on a card deck. Some people remember what that is, not many.
Did you drop it? Did you ever drop the deck?
What's that? I did not.
Okay. Good for you.
I had 36 rubber bands around it, George. That deck was not going to get unsorted on my way to put it in the silly card reader. But yeah, and then afterwards I knew Pascal very well when I left school. And I actually started programming in Fox Pro for about a 10-year period in my life, which was a DBase 3 clone, much faster, much more efficient, able to do things very quick. And it had a great programming language behind it.
Was it compiled or interpreted?
You compiled it, yes. Okay. You compiled it and then ran. That's why it was so much faster than DBase 3 was. The interesting thing about that is I don't know that you can find any of those programs anymore. I'm guessing you could probably find a Pascal compiler somewhere, maybe even a Fortran compiler, but they're really excited. I want to get a t-shirt, I think, that says, if you know how to program in PHP, you know, there's a Echo archaic language, and then close that out.
Yeah. No, coding is an interesting thing. I still do it occasionally. I write some PHP code for my online radio station and do some things. I did a little Python work in the company I work for a little earlier in the year. I'm going to need to go back to that Amazon skill at some point and get it's never been put in production and I've got to clean it up. And I'm betting I'm going to do a little vibe coding to make that happen. So I think the vibe coding is an awesome option. It's fascinating, but I'm going to double check the work and make sure it's doing what I want it to do.
George, one quick thing I wanted to say about vibe coding. I've had a fairly significant project that I've worked on over the last couple of months. And there is a point when basic OpenAI or basic Claude, I assume, won't quite cut it. And you'll be prompted to purchase credits to go into Codex in the OpenAI environment to develop your application. And you'll have to pay for that a little bit more than you would normally once your project gets complex. But then it can live there and you can modify it like you would like to do and do other things. So, George, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for visiting us again on this Tech with Beck segment on Main Street.
All right. Looking forward to next week, man.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for The Middle Live. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Extra, extra, read all about
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and on Thursdays, we try to get with our news director here at Prairie Public, Dave Thompson, to review this week's news. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig. Good to be here.
Dave, the North Dakota lawmakers met in a special session earlier this year in January, and they may be meeting again, we've learned. What's the latest?
Well, in January, they talked about that new funding coming in through the Big Beautiful Bill to kind of shore up rural health care. This one might have a health care thing to it as well, and that's kratom. And, you know, kratom is sold in some of the vape shops. There's some effort that they'd like to at least maybe put some regulations on it or ban it outright. So there's a discussion of that. But one of the other thing that in that's going to be in the special session, it appears, is how to, you know, take care of a funding shortfall for the new Veterans Museum that is close to, you know, is on the Capitol grounds. They had fundraising out there, but the fundraising has come up short, and right now construction has stopped on it. So there's some possibility that the state might put some more money into it or maybe do some kind of loan to the Bank of North Dakota. Those are the things the legislature will try to consider, and it looks like they might be maybe meeting in a month or two. The dates have not yet been set, but they've been talked about. But they said it will take at least 3 days, and that's statutorily, you have to have 3 days for a special session.
Dave, when it comes right down to it, who sets the agenda for a special session? In other words, who decides what bills can be considered and only what bills can be considered?
That's up to the leadership. That is the leadership of the majority in both houses. And they will decide through a delayed bills committee who is going to get their bill introduced, who is not going to get their bill introduced, and try to limit the whole idea to just a couple of subjects. They don't want to meet that long because it's getting close to harvest season. There are some people who say, you know, we're meeting in special session a couple times. Maybe a lot of lawmakers may say we might have to go to annual sessions. That's another discussion for another day.
The thing that's interesting to me is the regular session really now is not that far away. Yet the governor apparently and legislative leaders have said these two issues, they're worth meeting about right now. So we'll see how that progresses forward, Dave. Dave, some good news from graduation rates relative to the state of North Dakota. You know, Dave, in your reporting, the state in 2012, its graduation rate for all students was 52% in public schools. That surprised me, and it's way up from that.
It did me too. And now the rate's 83%. And part of the reason is that they're, you know, in terms of the Indian Education Conference Summit, which was held at the state capitol today, they're training teachers and giving them techniques in order to be more inclusive in their classrooms for Native American students, for example. And that's where some of the non-graduates were, because they weren't really getting a lot of education or a lot of things that were, you know, tailored toward them or focused toward them. And now with this effort, that graduation rate has really gone up. But they all said 83% is great, but there's still 17% we need to reach.
Dave, NDSU Extension is reaching out to farmers to talk about mental health.
Right. And, you know, I've heard this from people at the North Dakota Farmers Union, the North Dakota Farm Bureau, other farm organizations. They worry that in a time when then farmers are being squeezed because they're high input costs and they're low commodity prices, not able to ship product out, some of them, you know, may get depressed and may think about suicide. So they're trying to focus on mental health, making sure that farmers and ranchers know that they're needed, that they do have somebody they can talk to. You can reach out to people to talk about your issues. And really, they're going to try to prevent as many suicides as they can.
That's really a good idea. Of course, we want to send the message that there are people who are willing to help. It's only a phone call away. Anyone listening can dial 988
right, and
get help immediately if they are anyone they know is thinking about suicide. So we want to make sure that that message is consistent. Somebody is willing to help. Dave, the last thing I want to talk about today is North Dakota utility regulators are taking up an MDU rate increase, maybe even some data center cases.
That is correct. There's a lot on their plate regarding electricity right now. They will be holding public hearings on MDU's requested 14.5% electric rate increase. And the utility is saying in this case, this is not tied to data centers. Instead, the investor owns, and a lot of the co-ops have instituted large load things for the data centers. They're paying a different rate, so it won't affect the other other ratepayers any negatively. So they're really looking to keep, you know, what we use in our homes, in our businesses down, but they do want to, you know, face the fact that data centers are huge users of electricity, and they said they're going to have tariffs for them to pay for that use.
Dave Thompson and I like to meet on Thursdays to review North Dakota's news. Dave Thompson's our news director here at Prairie Republic, and Dave, we are appreciative of your time today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Craig.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 30th, the date the Apple Creek fight began in 1863. It's written and voiced by Dakota Goodhouse, Hunkpapa Lakota Yanktonai, who is also an interpreter at the State Heritage Center and Museum in Bismarck.
It was early June 1863 when over 3,000 soldiers under the command of General Sibley marched into Dakota Territory to engage the Sioux Indians in a punitive campaign following the events of the 1862 Minnesota-Dakota conflict. Intense drought in 1863 had driven game from the Great Plains. Bison, the main source of food of the Lakota, disappeared. By midsummer, the Hunkpapa crossed the Missouri River to hunt bison in the muddy wallows of the Pothole Lake region. The Yanktonai, whose traditional homeland centered on the James River, decided to do the same. Some of the Santee fled west into Dakota Territory. They wintered at Spirit Lake, and by midsummer of 1863, they too decided to hunt in the Pothole Lake region. It was coincidence that brought these three groups together near Big Mound, when General Sibley arrived. The Hunkpapa and Yanktonai had nothing to do with the 1862 Minnesota-Dakota conflict, but were caught up in the fight nonetheless. Hunkpapa leaders like Sitting Bull, Waxen Red, Black Eyes, and even Red Tomahawk defended the people alongside Dakota leadership of Inkpaduta, White Lodge, Two Bear, Standing Bull, and many others. These leaders organized a sinuous escape west across the landscape to Apple Creek, which allowed thousands of women, children, and elders to ford the Missouri River. Many were still crossing the river when General Sibley's command appeared at the eastern edge of the river valley. About 500 warriors took the hill they called the Bluff, where they gather paint. Soldiers chased women and children into the river. Many survived by cutting reeds and breathing through them. They held on to stones under the water until nightfall, before emerging. Others were not so fortunate and drowned. Those who crossed successfully took the hills on the western edge of the valley and flashed sunlight on mirrors to signal to the men on the bluff that they made it. The Apple Creek fight lasted from July 30th, 1863, to August 1st. Sibley's command was unable to take the hill, and he was unable to take prisoners. On the last day of the fight, General Sibley withdrew his command from the field. This was the only Native victory of the 1863-1864 punitive campaigns. Dakota Datebook by Dakota Goodhouse.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Intense heat and strong winds are fueling major wildfires across much of southern Europe. In France, firefighters are working to contain a huge blaze near one of the country's most important wine-growing regions. Correspondent Eleanor Beardsley gives us the latest from Bordeaux on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this Thursday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Monday on the show, supporting people with Down syndrome across North Dakota. We'll check in with Designer Jeans of North Dakota They connect people with Down syndrome and their families with support, education, and opportunities. We hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we look forward to seeing you again Monday, right here on Main Street.